From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Writer V.S. Naipaul has traveled the world, writing about the clash of cultures in post-colonial societies. But for his new book, Naipaul toured the American South. On today's Fresh Air, V.S. Naipaul talks with us about his travels. Actor Mandy Patinkin starred in the movies Yentl and The Princess Bride, and in the Broadway musicals Evita and Sunday in the Park with George. Today we talk with him about his new album of classic American songs. Rock historian Ed Ward plays some women rockers who tried to capitalize on Elvis Presley's success. And television critic David Bianculli previews Anything But Love, the new sitcom starring Jamie Lee Curtis and Richard Lewis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Writer V.S. Naipaul writes from the perspective of someone who's never felt completely at home in his country. His parents were Indian Hindus who had emigrated to Trinidad. Growing up in multiracial Trinidad as a member of the Indian community, Naipaul says he always knew how important it was not to fall into non-entity. Naipaul left Trinidad in 1950 to attend Oxford and has lived in London ever since. But he's traveled around the world to Africa, the Caribbean, and India, writing fiction and nonfiction set in post-colonial countries. Elizabeth Hardwick described his vision as fixed upon the brutal collision of cultures, the anguish of whole countries and peoples unable to cope. In a review of A Bend in the River, a novel set in Africa, John Updike wrote, Naipaul writes of an Africa of withering colonial vestiges, terrifyingly murky politics, defeated pretensions, omnivorous rot, and the implacable undermining of all that would sustain reason and safety. Rage is perhaps the deepest and darkest fact Naipaul has to report about the Third World. Naipaul's nonfiction books include Among the Believers, An Islamic Journey, which is based on his travels through Iran. His novels include A House for Mr. Biswas and Gorillas. His latest book, A Turn in the South, is a travel book about the southern United States. I asked him why he wanted to write about the American South.
It had never occurred to me to write about the American South. I suppose because one had spent so much time in... When one came to America, one went to the, you know, New York and... Then Connecticut. There was a little foray into California at one time. I never thought of the South, and I suppose the other reason for that was that the South's racial reputation was so dreadful when I was a child that one really put it out of one's mind altogether. But then I was asked by the New York Review of Books to go to Dallas for the Republican Convention of 1984, and I was, first of all, terribly excited by the great heat of Dallas in August. Heat contrasted with the excellent central air conditioning of the hotels and the convention halls. So one always had this physical excitement of moving from pleasant environment to something immensely hot, stimulating, dark shadows. I like that. And then I saw in the hall itself the flags of the state laid out, I suppose, in alphabetical order. And I began to recognize then that some of the older states were British colonies, as much as the colony I had grown up in. And that since my colony was also a slave colony, that there was an awful lot in common, and I was amazed that I had never thought of going to the American South to see what I could pick up and, you know, to see the similarities, because I've always traveled about the world to look at places with which I am connected according to my background, because I was born in Trinidad of Asian immigrant family, so naturally I've been interested in India. England, of course, I've, you know, been living in because it was the language I spoke to and we were a British colony. And Africa I went to have a look at, and other colonial territories like Argentina I also went to look at. And then it was such a revelation to me that here was a big gap. I should go. Well, that was why I went.
What was your strategy when you got to the South to figure out who to talk to and where to go?
I moved by instinct. And this book is written in a slightly different way from other books of similar nature, which I've done, which have been travel books and books of exploration. I figured that the more complicated a history, the more tormented the past, the easier it would be to understand it in human terms. If one could get someone's story, for example, and if one could extract the full meaning from a human personal account, a lot would be delivered, and one would get this in this direct way rather than attempting analysis, which really it's not something I could have gone to do, because you could spend a lifetime and write about the South. I didn't want that. I wanted to approach it as a novelist, and I thought that through the human stories you could pick up the themes and motifs of the place. You could get an idea of the history, you could get an idea of the stresses, and that was the way I worked. I did it through the people I met. At the beginning, one was scattered, one just picked people up and people who talked to one. And then in their stories, then one got all the various strands one could follow up later. One got the idea of the importance of religion. One got the idea of the depth of the history, and one got the idea of the Southern defeat. And, of course, inevitably, the racial tensions. And as one traveled along then, one explored different things in different places, always so one looked for different people. It's an instinctive, intuitive exercise. And in fact, it's perhaps very hard to describe fully, but it is the talent, that is the writer's talent, which has been developed over a long time. I don't suppose it would have been easy for me to do when I was just starting.
One of the people who you spoke to was a self-described redneck, and he interested you a lot. And in a way, I think this is the passage that you've come under the most criticism for, because this is someone who spun stories about what redneck culture was like.
Yes.
But kind of leaving out a lot of the more unsavory parts.
Yes.
Like not really directly expressing some of the racism that goes along with that. Go ahead.
No. I think I've won a lot of... that's been caused a lot of delight, really, the bit about the redneck bit. It's wrong, for people to expect writers to write the books that the reader wants to write. A writer has to write his own book. And here, you see, you already know about the racism of the redneck. Why do you want me to write a book about the racism of the redneck? Isn't that taking coal to Newcastle, writing a book you've already read? A writer has to do new things. If I had to write a book which had already been written by lots of other people, the pen would fall from my hand. And I thought that in the South, especially, everyone knows the motifs of the civilization. Everyone knows the history and all the racial tensions. I don't think you have to go rubbing it in all the time. And I think the fact that the rednecks are racist is also said there. But that wasn't enough. They're much more interesting than just being racist. They are people. They have their own codes. They have their own loyalties. They have their own way of living. And I wanted to have a look at that as well. That was presented to me, and that had to be explored. I couldn't blind myself to it and keep on correcting it. Nor could I talk to people and then go away and then, in the privacy of my writing, cut them down to size when I didn't do that in my first personal encounters with them. No, I couldn't do that. I would like in my writing to remain loyal to the way I talk to people. And if they were taking me in and talking to me about things and I didn't fight with them, I wasn't going to fight with them later.
Now, you talk about not writing the book that everybody could have already written.
Exactly. People like old books, That's the trouble. We all read. I know, I've done it myself. You read a book, you turn the pages, you're looking for the book you think should be there.
Well, what really interested me, you saw a lot of Elvis Presley fanatics, and you went to the Grand Ole Opry, and you were really surprised at the hold that singers and musicians have over Americans. And I just take that so for granted. It was really interesting to read somebody who was so surprised by it and trying to come up with an explanation for it.
Yes, well, look, that now, this is where I must confess the deficiency, because, you see, I'm not musical. So then I understood that although I wasn't musical, I would have to do something about it with that deficiency, although I didn't know about music, you know. And there it is, as someone said to me in Nashville, it is white soul music. And so I was able to talk to some writers of it and understand the great art that goes into it. Although it's formula writing, isn't it? And the poverty out of which it came out, the melancholy, the nostalgia, and the kind of sentimentality. Now it's extraordinary, isn't it? That sentimentality of people you consider rough. Such sentimental people. So that was interesting to me.
My guest is writer V.S. Naipaul, and his new book is called A Turn in the South. You've made a profession, in a way, of going to other places and writing about them in nonfiction. You've also, of course, written many novels. Is this in part because you felt like an outsider wherever you've lived?
That's too romantic.
Okay.
That's too romantic. Uh-huh. That's too romantic. No, it's a very practical matter. If you come from a small and limited background, and you are a writer, you train to be a writer, you've dedicated your life to being a writer, that little background quickly exhausts itself so far as material goes.
Translated, how many novels could you write about Trinidad?
You can't do very many, you see. You can't write, let's suppose you want to write books about crickets, you know, or ants.
Yeah.
Ants are very old, but you can't do a lot about ants. You can perhaps write about the rights of the ants, and that'd be one good book. Then perhaps you can do a fantasy book about an ant who wants to break away, but then can't survive alone and goes back to living with the rest of the community. But I think that would be or the ant repelling an invader. That would be the limit of your, you know, what you could do with, this is a frivolous way of talking about the limitations of small societies, for fiction. But yet the talent and the wish to write is there, and so one wanted to look at the bigger world. One shouldn't deny oneself the large world. If you grow up in a small place, you dream of the large world. In America, many people leave their small places to come to the big cities. And so that has been the drive as well, that it's very hard to write about, first of all, small places, and then it is very hard to write novels about fractured experience. I left Trinidad when I was 18 and been knocking around the world for 38 years. The novel flourishes best if one is writing about fixed societies with recognized codes. To write novels about mixed-up worlds is not so easy. You do one, you can do two. You can't do a series. You have to find ways of expressing your interest in the world. And my way has been this looking at other places.
You grew up in Trinidad, as you've said, and your parents were Indian. They were Hindu. What brought them to Trinidad?
They went there to work in the plantations after the abolition of slavery. Slavery was abolished in the British Empire about 1834, and the plantations went to rack and ruin, as the planters said. And sometime in the middle of the 19th century, this great social and human engineering that the British Empire got up to, people from India were sent out as indentured servants, and that's my origin. My origin is that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've said that you don't think of yourself as a believer. Talking about religion here, did you grow up as a believer?
Never. I was born without it. Born without it.
I guess it surprises me to hear that. Maybe I'm just thinking stereotyped, but I would just assume that Indian parents of Hindu descent would bring you up in a pretty religious atmosphere.
In a religious way.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was just born without it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You came across, and this goes back many years, but you came across a very interesting story about your father that you didn't know until years after the fact.
Yes.
And the story I'm thinking of here is, this was a headline in a newspaper article, and your father was a journalist in Trinidad. And the headline was about a journalist who made a goat sacrifice to the goddess Kali.
Yes.
Would you tell that story?
I wonder if I can reconstruct it, really. It's a terrible story. My father was a very young man and writing really quite nicely, considering he more or less self-educated. And he did something about something critical about Hindu or Indian farmers in central Trinidad who were not vaccinating their cattle against some kind of disease, and were instead doing superstitious rites. And this terribly offended some local people. And my father was threatened with death. Now, in another world, or in a braver, a fictional world, the reporter would say, rubbish, I'm not going to perform any rites to Kali. But if you're living in the country and you're threatened with death, then you do buckle, you know. And the poor man did perform the rite to Kali, and I think it damaged him ever after.
How so?
I think he was psychologically damaged by it, because it's a deep, deep humiliation, isn't it, to make a man go through rites he doesn't believe in.
Is that why you think he never told you about it?
He never told me about it, no. He never told me about it. And I discovered the story purely by accident, because someone from the New York Times had spoken to me in 1970, and when he was writing up his story, he sent me this clipping from an American paper, which is the first time our name was mentioned in New York, I think, 1934, thereabouts, where my father had done this goat sacrifice to the goddess Kali. And I had to say I didn't know. And then I went and looked at the old papers in 1972, and there was this terrible story, yes.
And what effect has the story had on you?
Well, none on me, really. You know, I think about my father rather than this. It has no effect on me. It hasn't, you know... Does it made me very brave and things like that?
No, or is it an example of the kind of thing you wanted to get away from when you left Trinidad?
Oh, no, it isn't Trinidad. That is universal. Oh, that's universal, this thing to make people recant. Oh, that's universal.
Well, do you see any connection between that and between the Ayatollah's death sentence of Salman Rushdie?
I think there might be something like that, but there is no connection. There is no connection. It's just that writers can be. You see, we are as strong as our societies permit us to be. If our societies don't give us enough protection, then we have to be as weak as our societies compel us to be. If you're Galileo, you have to say, yes, all right, the world doesn't move. And then as you walk away, you just mutter under your breath, but it still does, though, but that's all you can do. You're as strong as your institutions. That's all.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your writing, but first we're going to take a short break. Writer V.S. Naipaul is my guest. His latest book is called A Turn in the South. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer V.S. Naipaul is my guest. I'm just thinking about the comment that you just made, that a writer is as strong as the society that they live in.
Yes.
And I wonder if you think that a lot of writers are afraid to speak out now about Salman Rushdie.
I don't know about that. Okay. But I'd like to say that probably, in fact, when societies become awfully corrupt, mm-hmm. the writing becomes corrupt inevitably. If you're in Russia, you have to find ways of writing. If you are in, shall we say, Latin America, you have to find ways of not being realistic, ways of not analyzing your society, and some people find different ways of doing it, and there's a whole South American school of fantasy, which is really a way of not offending the authorities.
Well, very recently, Nigerian writer Wole Soyinka spoke out against the Ayatollah. He called him a sick and dangerous man who has long forgotten the fundamental tenets of Islam.
Yes.
I was wondering what you felt it was in your power to do as a writer, to say something or not say something about the current crisis.
I wouldn't say anything, really. Mm-hmm. I have nothing. I wouldn't say anything about it, really. I just hope that, you know, it can be put right in some ways. This is a religious dispute. It's just made rather difficult because it's being conducted in a foreign country. It's an internal dispute about the Mohammedan religion. It's nothing to do with other people.
Well, someone's life has been threatened, though.
Yes, but I mean the dispute itself, the nature of the dispute. It's a theological dispute. It's a theological dispute.
You don't see it as a freedom of speech dispute as
no,
well?
No, I don't really. No, I think that's something else, really. That's something else, which has been unfortunately dragged into it. If this dispute was being conducted in Algeria, as it probably can be now, I mean, it would be quite different.
Okay, so you don't think that there are freedom of speech issues at stake?
Not really, not in that way. I think the idea of censoring freedom of speech is, as I said, it's just an accident, really. It's accidental in this thing.
Okay. Let's move on and talk a little bit more about your life. We were talking about living in Trinidad. You left when you were a teenager, went to Oxford University. Why did you want to go to England? I realize you got a scholarship there, so obviously that got you to England. But after you'd finished studying at Oxford, you stayed on in London. And it's interesting to me because that's the colonizer. You grew up in a colonized country.
Yes.
Why did you want to stay in England?
I want you to put yourself a little bit in my shoes. Where would you think I should have gone?
Oh, I have no suggestion, and I didn't mean that as a criticism at all, but...
No, the world was quite different in 1954 from the way the world is today. And, of course, if you want to be a writer, you have to be in a place where books are printed and magazines are printed and there are radio services and books are reviewed. You can't go to a place where books are not printed and not reviewed. I mean, books are physical objects. They're produced and they're sold and they're marketed and they're reviewed and they're libraries, you know. You can't just be a writer in a vacuum.
Did you feel that you were treated as a colonial in England when you arrived?
I think the words, yes, one was a colonial. One wasn't treated as, one was a colonial.
Mm-hmm.
One was a colonial. Yes, one was a colonial.
So how did that affect your writing and your ability to get published and the interest in readers reading you?
Very hard, because there was no interest. There's no interest. It was very, very hard to get started. One's early books had a bit of a struggle. It was a long, long time before I could get my books published in America, you know, because there was no interest in writing from people like me.
You once wrote, "I couldn't be a writer in the same way as English or French writers of my age, because to be a colonial was to be spared knowledge." How did you compensate for that, if that's how you felt?
By that I mean that if you're an English writer or French writer, there's a mass of literature around you, and you were in any case writing to be more or less read by people like yourself. If you were a colonial writer, there wasn't such a mass around you. And the idea of the colonial experience was something you had to arrive at and work towards. You know, you have to work towards the truth, because the literature you had read was, as it were, the literature of whole societies. Do you understand that little point? Do you understand that point?
Yeah.
Do you understand that point?
I think so. Did you want to elaborate on it more? Or?
No, if we go on like this, I'll start rewriting all the books. we must just pick out what is, pick out a few things here and there.
In your book, The Overcrowded Barracoon, you say that you wonder why no one has done a study on the reasons for the popularity of books about racial discrimination. What made you wonder
about
that?
Did I say that?
Yes, you did.
Can you quote the thing for me? I've written so much over 30 years. I like things in context, you know.
Do you want me to quote that again?
Please, again. Please give me the context. Otherwise, it comes out at me, and I've been writing for such a long time.
No, I understand. that you wondered why no one has done a study on the reasons for the popularity of books about racial discrimination.
Yes. I think I don't know what you're referring to, but I think it appeals to a kind of sadistic element in some people. And I find a lot of the writing about racial discrimination a little distasteful for that reason.
But by sadistic, you mean people are secretly identifying with the oppressor?
Yes. It's a story of degradation that appeals to people. I think there's a little bit of that in it, yes. I think that might have been the prompting for that observation.
Well, you went on to say that for you it's never been easier to write a simple book about discrimination because, as an Indian, the oppressor was always changing.
Yes, how could you do it? Because the ideas now are getting getting so dense. You will see why one can't write a book about discrimination. To say that one is suffering from racial discrimination as an Indian or an Asiatic, you have to say then we are dealing with, shall we say, the British. Now, if you write that, you leave out, first of all, the failings of your own culture, which have exposed you to conquest. And they are very, very serious failings. Not to look at the internal failings of the culture would be a dereliction. You're looking at the failings of Indian family life, which are full of cruelties. Not to look at that would be wrong. If you're talking about discrimination and you just confine it to the British and you don't look at the discriminations in multiracial societies where every race has one set of rules and they don't get along quite well with every other race. That is too greatly simplified. And I think the subject is not important, really. I really don't think so in today's world. And I tell you why I don't think so. I think all these principles about racial justice and everything else have been conceded a long time ago now. And to talk about them as though they still have to be won is really to be sitting on a very, very, be batting on a very easy wicket.
Well, I know what you mean, but on the other hand, the fact that they've been conceded in many areas doesn't mean that they're actually being practiced.
No, I said conceded. The principles have been conceded.
Right, but if the principles have been conceded, it doesn't mean that racism isn't
exactly
still being practiced.
I'm not going to fight. That's what you see, I speak precisely. Mm-hmm. I did said the principles have been conceded. Mm-hmm. And I cannot then go around with a book ticking off where the places where the principles have been conceded but they're not practiced. That's for somebody else to do, Mm-hmm. I mustn't keep on doing the things you want me to do,
What are you working on now? Are you working on?
I'm just looking around and trying to enjoy meeting people.
Do you get nervous during that process when you're looking around?
No. It's fun. I love looking around. I'm very stimulated when I'm looking around.
And you're always confident you'll come up with the subject
No. I'm not confident at all. A lot of my time is spent in anxiety.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
All right.
My guest has been writer V.S. Naipaul, and his new book is called A Turn in the South, and it's about his travels through the American South. It's just been published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross. And this is Fresh Air. And next time I'll speak with film director Robert Wise. During his decades in the film industry, he's directed close to 40 movies, including The Body Snatcher, The Day the Earth Stood Still, West Side Story, and The Sound of Music. His new film is Rooftops. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Mandy Patinkin starred on Broadway in Sunday in the Park with George and Evita. And he starred in the films Yentl and The Princess Bride. He's just tried something new, an album of classic American songs. Coming up, we talk with Mandy Patinkin. It seemed like a good idea back in the late 50s, a female Elvis Presley. Our rock historian Ed Ward explains why the idea never got off the ground. And television critic David Bianculli previews the new ABC sitcom Anything But Love. It pairs actress Jamie Lee Curtis with stand-up comic Richard Lewis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Nora Rahm in Washington. Eastern Airlines has asked a federal judge in Miami to order its pilots back to work, saying that the life of the carrier is now on the line. A ruling in the case could come tomorrow. Rick Stone has more from Miami.
District Judge Edward Davis has agreed to decide tomorrow whether the walkout by the Airline Pilots Association is a legitimate sympathy strike by the pilots or an illegal primary strike to influence their own contract negotiations. Whatever it is, the pilots' action has staggered the airline, which today laid off nearly 6,000 employees and canceled all but a handful of its flights. If the pilots are not prevented from carrying out this strike, said Eastern lawyer David Ross in his argument for a back-to-work order, Eastern Airlines cannot survive. James Lindsay, who represents the pilots, called Eastern's lawsuit frivolous.
It's not the fact that it's an unlawful strike, which it's not. It's the fact that it's a successful strike.
Lindsay said if Eastern has truly been hurt by the strike, it can either settle with the machinist union or ask the president to convene an emergency mediation board. For National Public Radio, this is Rick Stone in Miami.
Howell Heflin of Alabama today became the first Democratic senator to announce his support for the nomination of John Tower as Secretary of Defense. The Senate has been debating the troubled nomination for nearly a week. President Bush today told a group of veterans of foreign wars that he is sick and tired of attacks on the character and lifestyle of John Tower. Bush said the stakes are high in his fight to win Senate confirmation of Tower, whose drinking habits, love life, and ties to defense firms have put his confirmation in doubt. Most of the Democrats who control the Senate by a 55-45 vote margin oppose Tower. Only a handful have voiced uncertainty. The vote is expected to come later in the week. The West German government is praising a U.S. offer to remove the U.S. stockpile of chemical weapons in the country. The offer came from Secretary of State James Baker in Vienna for East-West talks on conventional arms reductions in Europe. Deirdre Berger has more on West German reaction.
West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl welcomed the unexpected U.S. offer today. He said he was pleased that U.S. officials were keeping a promise made to him that the weapons would be removed from West German soil. Kohl says he hopes the aging stockpile will be removed by 1990. There have been continual protests in West Germany since the U.S. started stockpiling the weapons here in the 1960s. Experts estimate between 2 and 5% of U.S. chemical weapons supplies are in U.S. bases in West Germany. In Vienna today, Secretary of State James Baker said he hopes the Soviets will make a similar offer to destroy their chemical weapons stockpile. Baker also called on the Soviet Union to tear down the Berlin Wall. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Cologne.
U.S. military officials in Frankfurt, West Germany, are questioning a soldier who disappeared for several days near the East German border. They say Michael Perry, who was reported missing February 21st, returned on his own over the weekend. Perry has not said much yet about his absence. An official said Perry will first have a chance to get legal advice, and then he would most likely be charged with going absent without leave. Perry returned with a desktop computer that had also disappeared. Saturday's scheduled launch of the space shuttle Discovery was postponed today following the test failure of a crucial electronic part. Discovery was originally set to lift off February 23rd, but the launch was delayed to March the 11th, because of engine problems found on its sister ship, Atlantis, which engineers believed had the potential for occurring on Discovery. The new delay sets the launch date back to March 13th at the earliest. Missouri has been hit by one of the worst storms in the state this century. 14 inches of snow have been reported, and heavy rains have caused new flooding in Tennessee and West Virginia. This is National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Back in the 1950s, honky-tonkin' was a mostly male sport, and making the music that accompanied it was also the domain of boys and men. But when Elvis came along, there was no holding back the girls. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a survey of the women who tried to reign as queen in the shadow of the king.
Wild, wild young men like to have a good time. Wild, wild young men like to have a good time. Wild, wild boyfriends like to lose their minds. Wild men dig me.
There are some questions that seem to make sense until you ask them. Thinking about the 50s a few weeks ago, somebody asked me, in all innocence, why wasn't there a female Elvis? It would seem to make sense, after all, that if Elvis gave the girls something to scream at, and if screen idols like Marilyn Monroe and Natalie Wood were stirring up the boys' hormones, that a girl rockabilly would be a money-making machine. And it turns out that the answer to the question of a female Elvis is that there was a female Elvis. There were a dozen of them. But you've never heard of them unless you're a real rockabilly fanatic or a country fan. That's where a lot of these young women came from, and where the ones who succeeded wound up.
Gonna tell Aunt Mary about Uncle John. He claims he got the misery, but he has a lot of fun. Oh, baby, yeah, baby. Ooh, baby, they're gonna have some fun tonight. Yeah, well, long tall Sally, she's built with peach. She got everything that
my favorite was Wanda Jackson from Maud, Oklahoma, who was Capitol Records' entry into the female Elvis sweepstakes and who, as you can hear, was perfectly capable of rocking out. She recorded lots of straight country just in case the rock and roll fad didn't work out, and that's the path she took until a religious conversion more or less ended her recording career. If you can find any of her old records, though, listen to them. Unfortunately, they're very hard to find, and the rockabilly stuff is only in print in France. RCA Records had the original Elvis, so they figured they had the inside track. When pretty teenage Janis Martin showed up in Nashville in 1956, they thought they'd found what they wanted.
They can call you Bill, or even Billy, but you're my sweet William and you drive me silly. Oh, Will, Will, you thrill me to my fingertips. William, 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 yum, 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 I love your tasty lips. William, William.
Janis's first record, Will You William, was a stone flop. And for her next record, they gave her something tested and true.
Hey there, baby, jump over here. When you do the ooby-dooby, I just gotta be near. Ooby-dooby, 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 ooby-dooby.
Of course, this was before the record industry learned that rock and roll fans don't buy multiple versions of a song, and Roy Orbison had already milked ooby-dooby dry. So the last we hear of Janis is this.
Hey, everybody, come on down. The man with the guitar just hit town. Takes off like a rocket, and there he goes. Rocking from his head down to his toes. My boy Elvis, real rock. My boy Elvis, real rock. With bambling, Elvis, sing for me. Heartbreak Hotel, in blue suede shoes. He walks away with all my blues. Take my troubles, take my pain, load 'em on that mystery train. My boy Elvis, real rock. My boy Elvis, real rock. With bambling, ooh, Elvis, sing to me.
It was her biggest record, but that wasn't saying much. By 1958, Janis Martin's career at RCA was over. Now, if you know much about the history of rock and roll at this time, you're probably saying, sure, you'd expect big labels like Capitol and RCA to blow it. The small independent labels were where the action was. True. And on Cincinnati's Fraternity label, where Lonnie Mack recorded, we find a female rockabilly whose records are pure gold in collector circles today, Sparkle Moore.
You should be labeled with a skull and a crossbones. Well, you're a jinx to my soul. Oh, yeah, you should be labeled with a skull and a crossbones. Well, you're a jinx to my soul. Oh, yeah. Well, you're a man as to wear a batter hopping up a prison, cause you look like a child driving everyone wild.
But, as you can hear, Skull and Crossbones had what might be called an eccentric vocal. She smoothed it out some for another record, Rock-a-Bop, but it didn't help much.
You take a rock and a bop where it's really neat, and you put them together with the rock-a-bop beat. Hey, Joe, hey, Joe, you're gonna do the rock-a-bop. Rock-a-bop, you're gonna swing your feet and let a rhythm ever stop, stop. Rock-a-bop, I said rock-a-bop. Rock-a-bop, I said rock-a-bop with me. Come on and rock-a-bop. Rock-a-bop, come on and rock-a-bop with me. You're gonna swing your feet and let a rhythm ever stop, stop. Rock-a-bop. Hey, rock-a-baby.
Fact was, people weren't buying male rockabillies that sounded like this, although today they're considered the top of the heap. No, the problem with all the female Elvises, including such unlikely personages as Alva Leslie, who combed her short hair back in a fair imitation of the original, but only succeeded in looking like a male impersonator, was that they were girls. And in the 50s, girls were supposed to act in a certain way. It was liberating to see the raw sexuality and frenzied excitement of an Elvis Presley show, but nobody wanted their girlfriend acting that way. And anything less wasn't really rock and roll. It was pop, which is how safer acts like Brenda Lee made it to the charts. In short, nice girls didn't act like that, and bad girls started out with three strikes against them. It would take 20 years for female rock and rollers to get to be an accepted part of the landscape, and by then, Janis Martin, Sparkle Moore, and Wanda Jackson's rocking days had been forgotten.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Although he never formally studied singing, actor Mandy Patinkin has made a name for himself as a singer on Broadway. He won a Tony Award for the role of Che Guevara in the musical Evita, and he starred in Stephen Sondheim's Pulitzer Prize-winning musical Sunday in the Park with George. He also starred in several films. In Daniel, he played a character modeled on Julius Rosenberg. In Yentl, he was Barbara Streisand's study partner at the yeshiva. In Princess Bride, he played the Spanish swashbuckler out to avenge his father's death. And in Alienation, he played James Caan's partner from another planet. After filming Alienation, Patinkin went into the recording studio to make his first solo album. It features show tunes and pop standards from such composers as Irving Berlin, Stephen Sondheim, and Harold Arlen.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true.
What inspired you to make a record?
Well, I was pretty scared about doing it for a long time, I guess because I've always wanted to do it more than anything and was sort of afraid that it wouldn't be like, to be perfectly blunt, and didn't want to have to deal with that. But I'd done some show records of shows that I was in, Sunday in the Park and Evita, that kind of thing, and then CBS had asked me to do the South Pacific record with Kiri Takano and Jose Carreras and Sarah Vaughan, which I did, and that got a lot of attention. So from that, they said, would I be interested in doing something on my own? This was like a dream come true, but I was also utterly terrified. So basically, I said sure and then put it off for as long as I could.
You do several Al Jolson songs on the new record. Does Jolson have a special significance for you?
I just love that guy. I mean, I love what he did. I wish to hell I could have been alive to have seen him. I mean, yeah, I grew up in on the south side of Chicago. The first place I started singing was in my synagogue in the boys' choir and on the high holidays at Temple. That's all I knew. And I guess that was where he sang. The kind of cantorial cry that is in certain things that he does that the cantors do in the synagogue, I like that too. I try to find it. I if it happens in a song, I'm happy. It doesn't always happen in the same song that I'll sing, but when it does, then I feel like, all right, I'm praying good.
So your early public singing experiences were in synagogue.
My only.
Did you sing in school plays, anything like that?
Well, when I was 15, there was a youth center, Young Men's Jewish Council Youth Center on the south side of Chicago. And I remember my mom said to me when I was 14, I think, it was about 14, I was a freshman at South Shore High School in Chicago. And she said, why don't you go to the youth center? They're doing a play over there. Oh, no, I said, no, but nothing but sissies are in there. Forget it. I don't want to. And then I was in the lunchroom, and these big hulking football players came over to me and said, you know, we're doing this play over at the youth center. Why don't you, we need some guys. Why don't you come on over? And I said, yeah, okay, that's cool. I was thinking about that. So I go over there, and all these tough guys are in this thing. And they're doing Anything Goes, and they cast me as a Chinaman. And then, the director, a guy named Bob Condor, who really, it's funny with this stuff. How do you get into it? How do you find yourself in it? How do you stay in it? What happened? Where does it start? I think this fellow on the south side of Chicago, Bob Condor, is as much responsible as anyone, simply because he loved doing this stuff. He loved working with kids, and he had an enthusiasm that out of this small group of people, I think, in a small group of people, I don't know, there were 30, 40 kids, 50 kids at times, about 6 or 7 stayed in the business and make their lives in it, which I think is an enormous number.
You first really made your mark in professional theater on Broadway, in Evita, singing the role of Che Guevara. Did you very much want to sing on Broadway?
I guess so. On my bar mitzvah, my father took me to New York as my bar mitzvah president, and I saw 2 shows, Walking Happy and Anything Goes. I remember I waited by the stage door to meet Angela Lansbury. It was a great thrill. My father loved Mame. Not Anything Goes, Mame and Walking Happy. My father loved Mame. And when we got back to Chicago, I used to play the records of both those things and, do the whole shows in front of the mirror, and something happened there. I never really dreamed about it. I didn't think about it. Broadway wasn't in Chicago, so it didn't exist in my mind.
Let me ask you a few questions about your movie roles. In some of your first few films, you played Jewish roles in Ragtime, in Yentl, in Daniel. Was that coincidence, or did you start to get typed as somebody who plays Jewish on screen?
Well, the first real big part I had in films was Ragtime, and that was certainly a Jewish character. However, in my mind, he wasn't Jewish at all, other than the fact, because this guy was not a practicing Jew. He was he cut silhouettes, and then he became a movie maker, and these guys were not religious, let me tell you. So in my mind, he wasn't Jewish, in that religious way. The only really Jewish part that I ever thought I played was Yentl. But I understand the typecastingness of the way it all works. But it isn't just in terms of Jewish roles. It happens with every role I've ever played, and why I find the movie business a little bit difficult. And it is why I've tried to develop this music and why I'm working on it, because I'm tired of waiting 7 months or a year or more for roles that interest me. You do Yentl and you get 6 or 7 or 10 or 20 roles that are exactly that role. And I already did that role. I don't want to do it again. You do The Princess Bride and you get 10 guys that are swordsmen and kill 30 people before page 3. And that's how it kind of goes. That's the way the movies operate a lot. They like familiarity. They like to know. So if I don't like that, which I don't, and I like playing different characters, I have to wait a longer time till, somebody mm-hmm. whose mind stretches a little more can think of me.
Princess Bride was the first comedy that I saw you in. Perhaps you did others before that, but it's the first one I know of.
Right.
I was wondering if you had to prove to everybody that you could be funny, that you had comic timing, since most of your roles had really been very serious ones.
Well, Rob had known me before, and Rob had seen something else I'd done, so he was well aware that I could do some stuff that was funny.
This is Rob Reiner, the director.
Rob Reiner, yeah. the director. One of the things he talked about at our first meeting at lunch, he said, you know, what I want is guys that play this stuff real, but every now and then show a couple of cards in their hand, you know, so that they know that we're fooling around just a little. You know, prove things or not prove things. I think after a while you just desperately try to just do the work and not worry about if you're proving it. That's when you're at your healthiest.
Mm-hmm. You're coming out in a new movie soon.
Well, no, I'm going to make a new movie.
Are you going to make a new movie?
Yeah, I leave April 9th and I start shooting it. That's called Dick Tracy.
Do you get to sing in this?
Well, I'm supposed to. Whether it ends up in the final cut or not, I don't know. But Madonna's in it, and she plays Breathless Mahoney, who's in love with Dick Tracy, played by Warren Beatty. And I play 88 Keys, who's Breathless Mahoney's piano player. And Steve Sondheim wrote the songs, and he wrote a couple songs for Madonna, for which I'll play.
Huh.
And then he wrote a song for me, for which I'll also play the piano. But so I'm going to have my first adventure in that.
Oh, neat. So you'll really play piano. You're not going to have a stuntman playing for you, huh?
Should I tell? Yeah, I'm not playing the piano.
You're not playing,
let's
huh?
Let's be right up front right here. I'm just going to be wiggling my fingers on a dummy keyboard, and that's that.
Ah, shucks.
Because kids out there, I didn't take my piano lessons when Mom and Dad said so. I wasn't a good boy, and now I'm paying the price.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
The album Mandy Patinkin is on CBS Records.
Anyone can whistle, that's what they say, easy. Anyone can whistle, any old day, easy. It's all so simple. Relax, let go, let fly. So someone tell me why can't I?
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a look at what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, how are you covering the Eastern strike?
Well, we'll be hearing from Barbara Mantell about organized labor, showing perhaps a little bit more fight than we thought it had at this point in the Eastern strike. We'll also be hearing from Bob Kuttner about the pressures on airlines nowadays to not live up to their contracts with employees. On other matters, a story about Secretary of State James Baker in Vienna, urging the Soviet Union to renounce the Brezhnev Doctrine. That was the doctrine that was enunciated when the Warsaw Pact went into Czechoslovakia, in effect saying they would not try to correct any counter-revolution in Eastern Europe.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week, a new sitcom called Anything But Love premieres on ABC. It stars Jamie Lee Curtis and Richard Lewis, and one of its executive producers is television's Hooperman, John Ritter. Television critic David Bianculli has this review.
When I heard who was starring in Anything But Love, I expected it to be anything but bad. Jamie Lee Curtis is a good comic actress, and Richard Lewis is the funniest neurotic stand-up comedian since Woody Allen. So putting the two together, I thought, would make Anything But Love one of the most cutting-edge comedies on television. Sort of a late night with David Letterman mixed with a fish called Wanda. The pilot episode, though, isn't exactly what you'd call cutting edge. It's more like cookie cutter, stamped from the same assembly line mold as dozens of other TV sitcoms. Jamie Lee Curtis plays Hannah Miller, an ex-school teacher who decides to try her hand at being a writer. Richard Lewis plays Marty Gold, who's a star writer at Chicago Monthly Magazine. After meeting Hannah on a plane, he invites her to visit the magazine the next day to apply for a researcher's job. She does. If she didn't, there wouldn't be a series. The magazine's editor, played by Louis Giambalva, is a typical tough guy. He calls her a broad and a ditz and starts ushering her out of his office. Except that when the door slams, she's still on the inside.
I can take being called a broad, but nobody calls me a ditz. You obviously just don't know who you're talking to. I am not some airhead dilettante from the North Side. My father is a cop. I taught the inner cities, 3 tours. Most people burn out after one. I've worked all my life. I know life. I know people. I read this book. I loved it. I am the perfect person for this job, unless, of course, you would just rather have some snot-nosed brat that you can push around, in which case I should just go home.
Now, this is where, on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Lou Grant says to Mary Richards, "You've got spunk." I hate spunk. So what does this editor say?
"You've got a little bit of spittle just coming out of the corner of your mouth."
Same idea. Anything But Love has a lot of same ideas. It also has a lot of dialogue that sounds funny but doesn't sound natural. Robin Williams, Bill Cosby, and Roseanne Barr had styles of comedy that transferred well from stand-up to sitcom. Richard Lewis should, too, but the writers have to work on delivering character as well as punchlines.
Wait a minute, you dreamt about me?
I was Japanese. My mother was Rodan. She had these huge orthopedic wings, and she had lipstick on her beak, and she's pecking away. It's like, you never call, you never write. Hey, you take me to this cave. We're having mimosas with Fred Flintstone and Alice.
No, it's Fred and Wilma.
No, Alice is my girlfriend. Although I find Wilma quite attractive, too. It's that bone in her hair, I think.
Another problem, I think, is that Curtis and Lewis are cast as friends. If they were newsroom rivals, they'd be able to attack and undercut each other rather than just trade jokes. There's nothing wrong with the stars of Anything But Love. It's the script that needs work. If this Chicago Monthly editor really knew what he was doing, he'd hold the script in his hands and scream, "Get me rewrite." That's what Lou Grant would have done.
Anything But Love can be seen on Tuesday nights on ABC. David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, a talk with Indian director Meera Nair about her film Salaam Bombay. It's up for an Academy Award. The film is about homeless children who live on the streets of Bombay, and it stars street children and was shot on location in the red light district. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Locomotive. It's a new album from bassist Buell Neidlinger. Kevin describes the album as the sound you'd get if you crossed a bluegrass combo, a jazz rhythm section, and a drunken saxophonist. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.